I'd like to welcome you. Boy, how's that? I'd like to welcome you to this panel put together to explore the possibility of a middle ground or mutually acceptable compromise on the controversial issue of abortion. Because of the seriousness of this topic, I will dispense with such speech-giving niceties as the opening glib comment and proceed directly to the issue itself. Is it possible to be pro-life and pro-choice? Asked the headline of an article on abortion which appeared in, of all places, the Parade magazine, 22 June 1990. Written by Cosmos Man and noted scientist Carl Sagan and his wife and colleague Anne Druyan, the article begins, "For many of us, as far as public policy is concerned, the issue had been decided years ago. The court had chosen what we thought was the middle ground. You'd think the fight was over. Instead, there are mass rallies, bombings and intimidation, arrests, intense lobbying, legislative drama, congressional hearings, Supreme Court decisions and appointments, and clerics threatening politicians with perdition. Partisans fling accusations of hypocrisy and murder. The intent of the Constitution and the will of God are equally invoked. The contending factions call on science to bolster their positions. Families are divided. Husbands and wives agree not to discuss it. Politicians check the latest polls to discover the dictates of their consciences. Opinions are, in a word, polarized. Any discussion of abortion raises immediate and more remote but nonetheless germane questions for us as citizens and human beings, particularly given religious inclinations. Is it wrong to abort a pregnancy? Always? Sometimes? Never? What are our responsibilities to one another, to the unborn, if any? Should we permit the state to intrude into the most intimate and personal aspects of our lives? Where are the boundaries of freedom? When does personal morality or collective morality demand that we encourage political action on an issue which many believe blurs the bounds of church and state? And perhaps more fundamentally, when does life begin? Or theologically, when does ensoulment take place? What ultimately does it mean to be human? These and other questions are at the heart of our discussion today. But first, a word about format. The panel is organized somewhat atypically in that two of our panelists, Richard Sherlock and Richard Wilkins, will join together in attempting to articulate a middle ground, if you will, on this controversial topic, to which our other panelists, Father Thomas Kraft and Reverend Nancy Darnell, will respond. Richard Sherlock is a professor of philosophy, at Utah State University, and Richard Wilkins is a professor of law at Brigham Young University. Father Kraft of the Catholic Diocese here in Salt Lake and affiliated with the Newman Center will respond from the religious pro-life position, and Reverend Darnell, associate minister of the First Baptist Church, also here in Salt Lake, will respond from the religious pro-choice position. I want to especially thank Reverend Darnell for being here. She has not had a day off in a month, and this was supposed to be her day off. And Father Kraft, who, do you need to leave early? Okay. He has mass to say. I was going to say perform. I didn't know the verb involved. at 12:10, so we'll have him respond first. My task on this panel is to articulate at the outset, as impartially and accurately as possible, the official LDS Church's position on abortion, and following the presentations of our panelists, to act as a rather more aggressive, perhaps even intrusive moderator, should you, as audience members, not ask penetrating enough questions in the time we have remaining. Let me begin, then, by stating, as best I can, the LDS position on abortion. The Church's public statement on abortion is a mere three paragraphs long. It reads as follows. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has consistently opposed elective abortion. More than a century ago, the First Presidency of the Church warned against this evil. We again counsel people everywhere to turn from the devastating practice of abortion for personal or social convenience. Church policy recognizes that there may be rare cases in which abortion may be justified. cases involving pregnancy by incest or rape, when the life or health of the woman is in jeopardy, or when the fetus is known by competent medical authority to have severe defects that will not allow the baby to survive beyond birth. But these are not automatic reasons for abortion. The ethic and practice of elective abortion are fundamentally contrary to the Lord's injunction, "Thou shalt not steal, neither commit adultery, nor kill, nor do anything like unto it." We urge all to preserve the sanctity of human life and thereby realize the happiness promised to those who keep the commandments of the Lord. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints as an institution has not favored or opposed specific legislative proposals, public demonstrations, or picketing activities concerning the availability of abortion services. However, we continue to encourage our members as citizens to let their voices be heard in appropriate and legal ways that will evidence their belief in the sacredness of life. While Mormons are generally perceived to take an extreme pro-life position, this statement, strong initial language notwithstanding, indicates what I would characterize as a more moderate pro-life stance. It not only allows abortion in the case of incest, rape, or when the life of the mother is threatened, but also when the health of the mother might be impaired. We might infer here mental and physical health considerations. And in the case of a severely deformed fetus whose defects will not allow it to survive beyond birth. While the General Handbook of Instructions labels abortion as a sin under any other circumstances, it stops far short of calling it murder. Indeed, under the section heading Murder, it states, "Murder refers to the deliberate and unjustified taking of life. It requires excommunication. Abortion is not defined as murder for this purpose." As far as has been revealed, the handbook continues, a person may repent and be forgiven for the sin of abortion. There is no prescribed course of discipline for members who, and I quote from the handbook, submit to, perform, encourage, pay for, or arrange for abortions, unquote. However, the handbook does specify that male members who in any way participate in abortion, in aborting a pregnancy resulting from their sexual behavior, are not to be called on full-time missions. Beyond this, the Church has no official stand on when life begins, or, if you will, when ensoulment takes place, when the soul enters the body. There is an interesting genealogical policy, however. While the stillborn baby, as of about 7 years ago, may be named on genealogical record sheets, the policy is to record the stillbirth, but no temple work, in this case sealings, is done. This is not true of children who are born alive but die before the age of 8. One might infer then from this policy, therefore, that for Mormons doing genealogy and temple work, life begins at birth. This is the only indication that I've been able to find at all of any kind of a policy on when we consider a baby or a fetus human. In closing, I think it is important to note that the statement on abortion unequivocally indicates the Church's unwillingness as an institution to involve itself in the political or legislative arena in regard to this issue. And with that, I will turn the time over to first Richard Sherlock.
I thanks to the Sunstone people for putting on a panel like this. I know this is a difficult topic for many people to address for a variety of reasons. I find when I teach on this subject, it's a topic on which a lot of students don't want to get involved in a vigorous discussion. But I don't think it can be avoided, nor should it be avoided. These are issues that churches and society have to wrestle with across a wide spectrum of opinion. And it's one that is of particular salience, I think, to those of us in Utah, given our high Mormon percentage of the population and the ongoing political wrangling over this issue in the state. I want to do a few things in a very short period of time. And I know we do not have a lot of time, so I will try to be very brief. First, let me make 3 points right at the outset about the context within which I think this issue might profitably be looked at. The first question that came up in Laurie's fine introduction was the question of religion, and that relates to a whole cluster of issues. Does public policy with respect to abortion enforce one religion or another? And what is the relationship between one's religious convictions and one's other political or moral convictions that are difficult issues? But first, on these set of issues, let me make 2 points very briefly. First, abortion policy does involve a person's religious convictions. But so does almost every public policy in a society like ours involve one group or another's religious convictions. I see most of the people in this audience, or at least many of you, were old enough to have lived through, either as adults or as young adults, the civil rights movement of the 1960s. Now, the civil rights movement of the 1960s was profoundly grounded in religion. The leader that we now honor with a national holiday, Martin Luther King, they drop off the first 3 letters, Reverend Martin Luther King. And for those of you who are interested, in his original autobiography, which Stride Toward Freedom, which is the story of the Montgomery bus boycott, there's a point in there where Martin Luther King is ready to give up completely, just ready to throw in the towel. He's been threatened. He's getting death threats with midnight phone calls. Okay. And he does something that most of us in this audience would understand immediately. Who does he turn to for guidance? You got it. He gets on his knees and he asks God what he should do, and he hears the still small voice say, "Go forward." And at that point, you know, the decision in his mind was made. You know, the most powerful being in the universe, who represents absolute justice and righteousness, was saying, "Go forward, Martin, and I will be with you." Now, does that mean that the whole, you know, civil rights movement, because it was led from the black side by ministers and from the white side by ministers, the most notorious event in the that led to the passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Bill, which was the essential transformation of political power in the South. I mean, you can talk about opening up public accommodations, but once you gave 30 or 40, or in some cases 50% of the people now the right to vote, you know, deals had to be made and politics was never the same. But the event that touched that off was this Montgomery to Selma march, where a Unitarian minister was beaten to death. Public policy in a society like ours, which has as deep a religious conviction among its people, and we are the deepest religious industrial nation in the world, simply can't avoid these kind of entanglements. What then is the relationship between religion and ethics? Let me just say one thing about that. I think it's a very complicated relationship. Obviously, religious convictions affect moral convictions. But I do not think that one needs religion to arrive at sound, justified moral conclusions, nor does religion guarantee that you will arrive at such conclusions. I think ethics is an autonomous discipline, and we can learn much from the serious study of ethical issues, though religion plays a profound and complicated role in that relationship, and if questions come up on that, I'd be happy to get into them. Secondly, it is often alleged that whatever we do in a public arena on abortion is likely to be ineffective because people will simply seek illegal sources of abortion. I hear that repeatedly. It has been demonstrated to be false every time it's been studied, and I can provide references extensively on that. A third point I would make at the outset is that abortion seems to me not to be a question on which it is appropriate to conclude that simply whatever I believe is right for me and whatever you believe is right for you. That is moral relativism, and I'm thinking that moral relativism simply isn't an attractive position, and I would be prepared to defend that. Let me remind you that if moral relativism is true, then that legitimates equally the pro-life and the pro-choice side. And it also legitimates every bigot, every racist, every sexist who has a viewpoint, who simply says, well, my viewpoint is right for me. And my way of treating other people is right for me. Your way is right for you. But see, relativism legitimates every opinion. Now, if you can find positions on any public issue that you think aren't legitimate and shouldn't be thought of as equally correct morally, whether it be apartheid, whether it be nuclear war, whether it be genocide, then you have essentially given up relativism. Now, speaking then about abortion directly, it seems to me that when you look at the positions in the abortion issue, there are three positions that one can take. One is one can be an absolute pro-choice person. That is, that whatever the woman decides is both morally correct and should be, the public policy should reflect that sort of absolute pro-choice position. That there should be no restrictions either morally, that is, we shouldn't morally condemn people because what's, again, right for them is right for them and they're the only person to make that judgment. And that in public policy we should reflect absolute pro-choice position. That is the regime that we operate under today. That is Roe versus Wade, up to the point of viability. I shouldn't say the 24th week of pregnancy because the actual cutting edge point in Roe and the thing that gets them into enormous difficulty just conceptually is viability. Up to the point of viability, we have this absolute pro-choice position. You can take that position. Secondly, you can take a position that is somewhere in the middle. The Mormon Church's position reflects this, that sometimes abortion is morally appropriate and acceptable, and sometimes it isn't. And when it isn't, there should be legal restrictions on that. Sometimes it's morally and legally appropriate, sometimes it isn't. That's this middle ground sort of position. The alternative, the third alternative, is the absolute pro-life position, or the nearly absolute pro-life position. I don't know anyone who holds what might be thought of as the absolute pro-life position that never, ever, under any circumstances, abort. But what is usually reflected is the position that, with the exception of the recent statute passed by the Guam legislature, that's the only place I've ever seen that represented in the last 20 years, But the pro-life position that I'm calling the absolute pro-life position is the view that there's only one exception, when the life of the mother is at stake. But since with modern medical technology that is an exceedingly rare occurrence, it ends up being almost absolute. I mean, they will grant you that one exception, and what in practice that means, because that's very rare with the modern medical technology, that it ends up being in practice pro-life, or almost absolute in practice pro-life position. I think third positions on this spectrum are, to put it bluntly, and this will generate some discussion, I know, nonsense. It seems to me that there are more exceptions, and we can conceive of them. We may know friends or people we have had acquaintance with, or those of us who've ever been in positions of ecclesiastical authority may have known of situations in wards where abortion was performed for reasons that seem completely morally compelling to us. We can think of rape. Now, rape exceptions are not much because there aren't very many pregnancies as a result of rape, but because rape is a one-time affair and there are a lot of other things related to that we can get into. Incest, however, is another matter. And I think if anyone knows of those kinds of cases, I know of a particular case of rape of a teenage, a 13-year-old mentally retarded girl, and I don't think anybody in this audience would be prepared to tell me that abortion was not at least a morally acceptable alternative in that conclusion. Even if in their particular situation they might not have done the same thing, they wouldn't say that's utterly moral, that's beyond the pale morally. So I think the absolute pro-life position is too restrictive. On the other hand, I think the absolute pro-choice position simply can't be defended. And I will talk about that in a minute. But I think the absolute pro-choice position simply doesn't work. It is either defended on the basis of relativism, which it seems to me is an exceedingly poor moral philosophy, and I could defend that at length if we wanted to get into it. Or it is defended on the proposition that somehow the fetus isn't a human being. And therefore, we are not talking about the same kind of thing. Or that the fetus is probably not a human being. Well, let me then turn at the end to three points I want to make with respect to why I find the middle ground to be attractive. First of all, I find the absolute pro-choice position unattractive because I think that ultimately the fetus has a moral standing. The unborn, if you will, nascent human life, call it what you will, it is all of those, has a moral standing in our universe of moral discourse, in our society, in our community. I reject relativism completely as a moral position. I think it's just disastrous and indefensible. And I reject the proposition that the fetus shouldn't count. The problem with saying that the fetus is not human is simple. If it isn't, then neither are a lot of other entities that we obviously think of as human. There is no difference between an unborn baby at 36 or 37 weeks gestational age and the born baby. None. Gets not one more thing. And if you try to discover in the period of human development, from conception to death, some magic point where human being suddenly comes into existence, you are bound to fail. There isn't a magic point. It is a continuum of development. And as a continuum of development, it seems to me it deserves respect throughout. And even if you were looking for some point in pregnancy, the only reasonable points happen very early in pregnancy. If you're looking for a point, viability isn't it. The decision in Roe was utterly confused and wrong on that point. Viability can't be it, and we can talk about that. But if you're looking for a point, it's going to happen very early in pregnancy. For those of you who have had children within the last few years, I simply point out to you how early they can hear heartbeat and other phenomena in the fetus. Secondly, if the absolute pro-choice position seems to me to be unsatisfactory, so too does the absolute pro-life position. Because it seems to me that that does not provide enough of a balance between competing rights and interests at stake. Women do have a liberty interest at stake here. And in particular, they have a health interest at stake. And health interests are placed at risk in a broader range of circumstances than when your life is at risk. Enough said on that. Thirdly, let me just make one final point. Why I think that this viewpoint ought to be sensitively reflected in public policy. And I think that that is... I think the reason for that is that this is an issue that involves the taking of nascent human life. It isn't like having your appendix out, which was a feminist claim of some years ago. And if it is involved the taking of human life at some stage, then it cannot be a matter of your personal morality and mine. It has to be a matter of communal concern. And that's all the time I have. Thank you. It's great working with Richard because he approaches everything from such a broad philosophical bent, and I'm just a fuddy-duddy old lawyer, and I tend to approach things from kinds of nuts and bolts, and here we go, and here's how we do it. So let me try to address very quickly three broad issues from more or less a legal technical perspective on the issue. First, I'd like to address quickly why we need to change the nation's abortion policy. Second, and if we have time, do it in some detail, how that change can occur within the legal structures that have been erected by the United States Supreme Court. And finally, quickly address, at least my views, why I think from both a legal and a tactical viewpoint, we should adopt, legislate a middle-of-the-road approach. First, the need for change. It's quite clear, as the article that was read to you from Parade evidences, the abortion debate has become so intensely polarized in this country that something needs to be done. What happened in Roe versus Wade is the Supreme Court constitutionalized a fairly extreme pro-choice position, thereby taking the abortion controversy out of the range of public debate and policy. Legislatures could no longer affect the decision, and because of that, people were left with only one alternative: express rage. And they're doing that today. Now, people, of course, who want to protect Roe take to their barricades and say, we've got to save this constitutional right, and in between, now we just have war in the streets, and we may eventually have bloodshed over it. I almost did in my own home this past spring. That kind of debate suggests to me that we need to have legislative give and take. The way America works is when there is a difficult policy question, we let the legislators, the people's elected representatives, balance it out. And I submit to you, for many of the reasons that Richard has already discussed this morning, there is nothing fundamentally different about abortion from a whole range of other issues that we routinely leave to legislative give and take. And let me now, with that, move into how we make this change within the structure of Roe. And I'd like to begin with a brief foray into legal history. When I say there are many areas that are no fundamentally different from Roe versus Wade in which we permit debate, one example is economic legislation. If the state of Utah were to pass some sort of a regulation prohibiting or prescribing the number of hours in which bakers could work, would anyone think that that was somehow unconstitutional? Certainly not. However, back in the 1920s, the Supreme Court routinely struck down those laws as unconstitutional. In fact, in Lochner versus New York, they struck down a New York State statute that said bakers can't work more than 10 days. Why? The court said liberty rights are fundamental, and bakers' liberty to work more than 10 hours per day is fundamental. It belongs to the baker, and the legislature has no right taking it away from them. Now, that is in fundamental terms no different from what the Supreme Court did with abortion in Roe. They simply said the right to terminate a pregnancy is a fundamental right that belongs to the woman, and nobody has the right to take it away from her. It's her choice. So in the same way that the court back in the 20s preserved the baker's right to work 10 hours per day, the modern court protects a woman's right to terminate her pregnancy. Now, what happens, though, when the court does that? Well, the nation gets into a depression, and President Roosevelt and Congress enact legislation to try to get us out. And what does the Supreme Court keep doing? Striking it down as unconstitutional because it infringes on people's liberty. And what happens? The depression keeps getting worse and worse. Pretty soon people are out marching in the streets again about it, just as they are with abortion. President Roosevelt threatens his court-packing plan, just as President Reagan. I worked in his Justice Department, I should remember him, said that he would not appoint anybody to the Supreme Court that wasn't against Roe versus Wade. Well, what happened? The Supreme Court finally got the message, and they backed away from Lochner. How did they do it? Did they ever outright reverse Lochner? No. They simply changed the standard of review. When Lochner was the law, the court said, is there a compelling state interest that necessarily justifies this regulation? And unless there was, it was unconstitutional. Well, what they did in a series of cases is they said, well, does this further a substantial
state interest, and is it substantially related to something that's important? They took a middle step, and over the course of about 20 years, they backed away. Lochner is now effectively dead. Can you find a case on the books that reverse it? No. Now that brings me to what do we do with Roe versus Wade? Back in 1982, when I was assistant to the Solicitor General, Rex E. Lee, we filed a brief in the Supreme Court that essentially told the court, you need to do the same thing you did in Lochner. You need to change the standard of review. And the standard of review that we suggested was uphold abortion regulations so long as they don't unduly burden the abortion choice. It's a mid-range kind of an approach, and it permits the court to gracefully back away. We are now at a point where five justices of the United States Supreme Court have embraced that unduly burdensome standard. Now, what does that mean? We are clearly poised on the edge of change. What direction is that change going to take? Is the court going to outright reverse Roe, or are they going to go down a more moderate approach? Now, what got me in such terrible trouble last spring was I had the temerity to say, the court isn't going to outright reverse Roe, they're going to take a more moderate approach. And let me tell you why I think that's the case. First, history suggests the court rarely, if ever, takes a sudden, abrupt change. They don't do it. They didn't do it in Lochner. They didn't even do it with Brown versus Board of Education, the case that said separate but equal isn't constitutional and you have to put the black students in the white schools. People think that's a sudden break with tradition. It was not. Brown versus Board of Education was preceded by 25 years of school funding cases, which gradually changed the state of the law to which the court could finally announce that Plessy versus Ferguson was no longer good law. So history just says you don't do it. We only have also one justice on the Supreme Court that currently says, I'm in favor of outright reversal. That's Justice Scalia. Now, Justices Rehnquist and White have said in the past, in vigorous dissents, that they're in favor of reversal. They're no longer saying that. In the most recent, three most recent opinions, which have embraced the undue burden standard and upheld abortion regulations, they have taken a much more moderate tone. Why? Because they now understand they're in the majority and they have the steering wheel and they can change the course of the law. It's terribly disruptive to change the course of the law in sudden jumps. If the court were to suddenly and out of the blue reverse Roe versus Wade, we'd leave a hole in constitutional law about this big, and it's too big of a hole. Roe has worked itself into all kinds of areas of the law, many areas of the law that most of you in this room, I think, would agree with when it comes to rights of family members inter se and among themselves. Most of you would not want the court to back away from much of its recent jurisprudence in that area, and that jurisprudence is founded on Roe. So unless we're going to leave this big hole that I don't think anybody wants and the justices of the Supreme Court realize can't happen, they will back away. And that leaves us, I think, with this undue burden test. What does undue mean? Well, it's not entirely clear, but just let me give you, if we had more time, I'd go through a little more carefully, but I think what it means is that so long as a regulation that regulates abortion does so in a way that furthers a legitimate interest in either maternal health or protection of fetal life and doesn't impose some absolute obstacle telling the woman, no, under any circumstances, you can't have it, it will be upheld. What does that mean? It means informed consent provisions, waiting periods, parental notification laws, reporting requirements, fetal viability testing, requiring a second doctor to be present at late-term abortions to save the life of the fetus. All of these kinds of restrictions will be constitutional without more. Now, the recent cases also suggest that even if you have an undue burden, you can regulate so long as it serves a compelling state interest. Now, in the past, the minute you got to that test, which is called strict scrutiny, you were dead in the water. But Justice O'Connor and the current Supreme Court suggest that there may be state interests that justify regulation. What are those interests? Again, I could go through this a little more carefully if I had time. But what the recent decisions seem to suggest is that the court is terribly unhappy with the balance between maternal autonomy and fetal rights that was struck in Roe. Roe says maternal autonomy trumps the fetus until that fetus is viable. That's what's got the people in the streets. The court is unhappy with that. What the recent decisions say in broad terms is we are no longer happy with that balance, nor do we think that balance is necessarily required as a matter of constitutional law. Therefore, states, you can redraw the balance. Now, does that permit the states, as a matter of constitutional law, to simply say, okay, now fetal life trumps maternal autonomy? and pass a law such as was introduced in Utah and in the Idaho legislature, which has the effect of banning 99.9% of all abortions in these states? I don't think so, in a word. Now, let me just say quickly, the law that was at issue in Idaho, the law that was at issue down here in Utah, is not consistent with LDS Church doctrine. It goes substantially further than the church's position that was read to you this morning. That statute in Idaho, if it had been passed, the statute that Representative Nix has announced that she is going to reintroduce in the Utah legislature would tie the hands of LDS ecclesiastical leaders and would not permit abortions in circumstances in which LDS church doctrine permits them. I submit to you on many levels that should give you a clue that the current Supreme Court is unlikely to uphold it. Now, but what will the court uphold? I think the court will uphold a reasonable balance between maternal rights or maternal autonomy and fetal life. What is that balance? Well, I think there are several ways you could go about it. I think the states could legitimately draw a line very early in pregnancy and say, after 8 weeks, you have to have compelling health reasons to justify abortion. That would do away with 50% of the abortions right off the bat. I also think the court would uphold it because it wouldn't completely trump female autonomy or a woman's autonomy. It would say, you have an autonomy right, but you better exercise it early because that fetus has a right too, and at 8 weeks, we're going to start protecting that fetal right. There are other ways that you could also balance. You could say, all abortions are prohibited except when necessary in terms of maternal health, rape, incest, or fetal deformity. Now, in those circumstances, of course, maternal health would have to be construed quite broadly as including not only death but mental health, any concern that a woman and her doctor could legitimately say, this poses a serious health risk to me. Again, why would that be upheld? Again, I think the court might say, or at least there's a reasonable probability the court would say, that reasonably balances female autonomy with fetal rights because if there's a good reason for the abortion, it can occur. I have urged the Utah legislature to take that kind of a reasonable approach. Richard and I are writing an article right now where we're going to suggest that approach and have language to support it. I'm not so sure that the Utah legislature will take it. But let me now suggest the third thing, the final thing that I want to talk about, and what are the advantages of this approach. Very briefly, first, this kind of an approach has broad public support. The polarization of the debate that we keep hearing about masks one very important fact. 85% of Americans have already agreed what abortion policy should be, and that is it should be middle of the road. Opinion polls consistently show that if you ask people, should abortion be outlawed? 90% say no. Well, should abortion be available on demand? Again, almost 90% say no. If you get into when should it be permitted, they say when it's necessary in terms of maternal health, rape, incest, or fetal deformity. That kind of a statute is already what 80 to 90% of Americans believe should be policy. It is also the abortion policy that has been adopted by the vast majority of civilized nations in the world. There is, therefore, a strong political impetus behind this kind of a compromise because it's something we can live with. I don't think American society can live with either polar extreme. They're just simply unrealistic, again, for reasons Richard has mentioned. Second, I think this kind of a middle road approach has a good chance of success at the Supreme Court for reasons that I've stated. I think it would be a disaster from a tactical pro-life position to take the Idaho statute to the United States Supreme Court, because it's my firm belief the Supreme Court would have declared it unconstitutional. In the course of declaring it unconstitutional, they would have reaffirmed Roe versus Wade, and I don't want that. Roe versus Wade has not been reaffirmed now for 4 years. It has been explicitly chipped away at for the past 3 major decisions of the court. We need to continue that process. Finally, in a broader sense, I think a middle-of-the-road approach reasonably accommodates competing interests. I'm not entirely happy as a personal matter with the middle of the road. If I could impose my will on the nation, abortion policy would be exceedingly strict, probably only where the life of the mother was involved. In fact, that's not probably, that's certainly what it would be as a matter of personal choice. But I don't think I can impose that, in my view, on American society. the middle-of-the-road approach does what good political compromises have always done and historically have accomplished in this country, and that is give a solution that people can live with. Thank you.
I'm definitely going to have to keep my remarks brief, and I appreciate the talks given by both Richards. Very enlightening and excellent. I appreciate the fact to be able to be here, too. I guess in my own defense, I just got back from vacation, and so I haven't had a lot of time to go through this, and I really didn't know I was going to be here probably till this morning. One of the things I'm supposed to comment on, I guess, is the Catholic Church's position, and I think many of you probably are familiar with that. The Catholic Church has always officially condemned abortion. And that has a long history. I think it's important to look in the historical context. That is not something modern that some modern popes or theologians or whatever came up with. In the early part, or when Christianity was first began, in the first century, the Romans were practicing abortion. And so right away, they had to take the stand. What's going to happen here? And of course, they based their teaching upon the commandments of God. And one of the commandments, thou shalt not kill. And so it was pretty clear then in the eyes of the early Christians, abortion was outlawed. And so the Romans were practicing it. There was that force upon them maybe to practice abortion as well. But the Catholic Church made a position, and that position is held until this day. And in the modern times, there have been many statements on abortion, and I can just read a few of those from certain popes and councils. First of all, the Vatican Council, too, which I will quote from, said, life from its very conception must be guarded with the greatest care. Abortion and infanticide are abominable crimes. And different popes have commented on that. I'll just read a couple. John the 23rd recalled the teaching of the fathers on the sacred character of life, quote, which from its beginning demands the action of God the Creator. And more recently, Paul the 6th, he said, life must be safeguarded with extreme care from conception. Okay, and so it's pretty clear, and then in the modern times as well, just most recently, a few months ago, the U.S. bishops making a statement condemning abortion. So it's pretty clear in the Catholic Church that abortion is just not accepted at all. And the only time that it would be accepted would be an indirect abortion, which would mean that if the mother had a cancerous uterus, for example, a cancerous womb, and that had to be operated on. In the midst of that operation, and this was a pregnant woman, the pregnancy would be terminated somehow. That would be an indirect abortion. So all direct abortions are totally unacceptable. I think the issue, though, is very difficult, and even as some U.S. bishops have commented on recently, it is very difficult. It's a very complex thing, and there's many circumstances involved. I've known many women who've had an abortion. And it is. It's very, very complex. And I've spent a lot of time talking, crying, consoling, whatever. And there's a lot of pressure put upon women, I think, to have an abortion. And a lot of the women I know did not want to have it. And so I definitely think there needs to be a change in the law, as both Richards have commented on. I think an extreme pro-choice position is totally unacceptable. And there has to be a change. I guess, regarding the Catholic Church, I mean, all abortion is outlawed except for an indirect abortion. Now, I don't think that's ever going to be implemented in this country. But I do think that, again, as the second Richard commented, that there has to be a change. We have to get back more to the middle of the ground. I think it's also important to remember that before 1965 in this country, I mean, the general attitude, the abortion was an ugly, evil thing. And it was only between 1965 and 1973 when this mass media made a push to legalize abortion that finally, January 22nd, 1973, it was changed. But it was only changed in the courts. It wasn't changed in the legislatures. Remember that there were many states that continued to pass laws against abortion. And finally, the battle switched from the legislature to the courts, and then the courts made it legal. And I feel I feel this way, but as I've read in other lawyers and statements, that it was unconstitutional to do that, and I really do believe that as well, because the states had made their legislation, and then the court has changed that for everybody. So anyway, I think now, I'm not sure how many years later, just about 20 years later now, We are on the verge, I think, of some major changes in our law, and I think that's great. But I think from a religious viewpoint is that there has to be some other things done as well. And, a young woman gets pregnant and now she wants to have an abortion. What led to that step? Because all those things, I think, feed into the fact that yes, it's easy for the abortion alternative to be the only option at that time. So we definitely need, I'm definitely in favor of a greater sexual and moral education to help young people and all people come to a greater view of sacredness of life. And as far as a religious viewpoint, that's the whole point, is that there is a life conceived, and whether you believe that it's human at that point or not, what is potentially human is human. And so we need to protect that, and that's the religious viewpoint, is that that's the bottom line. So you start your argument from there. That's the point of departure, and not the fact that is it human or not, or the rights, or whatever. The fact is that there's a life there, and if life is not respected, then we're all in big trouble, and no one in this room is safe, because we can all fall by the sword. It's interesting note, I think in some South American tribe where abortion was allowed for many hundreds and hundreds of years, that the tribe is now consist of a few females and many males, and they're basically on self-destruct. And I think that's what this country is. When we continue to allow abortion on demand, we're just on self-destruct. And so we need a change, and we need it badly, and it's going to happen. I really do believe it's going to happen because, again, as Richard quoted, the general attitude in this country is that we need a change, and it will happen, so thanks be to God for that. But in the meantime, I think we need respect for life on all levels, and again, it's not just in the womb, but it's for the elderly, it's for the handicapped, it's for people with terminal diseases or whatever. We need that respect for life, because when that goes out the window, like it slowly but surely is, then again, no one is safe. We will kill ourselves. This country will self-destruct. So I'm not sure if I need to comment anymore. I'm just talking from my heart, I think. I do appreciate this time, and I'm sorry that I can't stick around longer for questions, and maybe I can come back. I'm not sure how long it's going to go, but I do need to be gone for half an hour to 45 minutes. And is it going to be continued after that? Oh, darn it, sorry. But I am sorry I can't, but I do appreciate this time here, and so I think I'll end with that. Thank you.
I've never spoken publicly about abortion before. I'm no expert. I only made a B+ in ethics. I've never had a philosophy class. I did make A's in theology. I've been ordained a year and a half. And I come from a Protestant perspective. But I don't mean to say to you that I represent a Protestant perspective, because that is by no means the case. I represent my perspective, but I will try to give you some current Protestant thinking about abortion. And then I will tell you what my thinking is. When you deal with theology, you always need to deal with your own story first. Theology always comes out of experience. How you read Scripture, how you understand it, how you sense good and evil comes from who you are and where you have been. One of the things about me is that I am a woman. And I am a woman who has always pushed at the edges of where I've been told I could be. I began in college studying geology because the guys who in the department were nice to me. And I went to graduate school, and I was told I shouldn't be in geology, that women in geology, they could only be secretaries. Well, I took that as a real challenge and spent 13 years as an exploration oil and gas geologist. But I'm just telling you that I've poked at edges of things. I went back to seminary when I was 36. I got married shortly thereafter. I had a baby when I was 39. My only pregnancy before that had ended in a miscarriage. I was in one of those life-threatening situations. My baby was born a full 2 months early at University Hospital with an emergency cesarean section. At 3 pounds, she was the largest, healthiest baby in ICU. I saw sick babies there. Protestant theology is always grounded in the Bible. There is not much said in the Bible about abortion. Now, we can make great leaps and say that the Bible speaks that abortion and murder are the same thing. Well, your own church doesn't say that, and neither do we. I will read you a passage of Scripture. I'll start with another one. In Exodus. This is Exodus 21, verses 22 through 24. When men strive together and hurt a woman with child so that there is marriage, and yet no harm follows, the one who hurt her shall be fined, according as the woman's husband shall lay with him, and so forth and so on. But if a miscarriage results from harming a woman, you will be fined. Now, earlier in part of Exodus, it says, whoever steals a man, that means kidnapping, shall be put to death. Whoever curses his father or mother shall be put to death. Whoever strikes his father or mother shall be put to death. I think, at least in the Old Testament, they were considered different things. A fetus was not the same. If you murdered, you were put to death. If you did something that caused the death of a fetus, you were fined. Protestants generally proof text everything. Protestants who say that we should only consider fetuses as life at birth, okay, viable fetuses. We'll quote the Genesis passage that said, and God breathed into man the breath of human life, and man became a living being at that point. I'm not here to argue that point. I'm here to argue several things. This is not a prepared presentation. I was really told sort of to respond to these people who, for the most part, have taken a fairly moderate stand, I believe. When we consider abortion, I think we are on very... I don't have a watch, so would you shake me about 2 minutes ahead?
I was only concerned about time because
okay.
Father Kraft had to leave. Now
right.
We have a little bit
okay.
Time.
All right. But don't let me go on it. When we think of abortion, I'm afraid we have fallen into a trap of seeing abortion as an isolated event. It is an act of abortion, and we forget all of the circumstances before and after that take place. I don't think it's an isolated event. If we're going to talk about fetal life, we need not to talk of, we also need to talk about the mother's life. if we talk about the quality of life of the fetus, and that's what we do every time we talk about disabilities, we need to talk about the quality of life of the mother or the family or the other children. If we talk about pain to a fetus, we need to talk about pain to the mother. Lots of arguments we have sort of assumptions, I think on both pro-life and pro-choice sides, that say pain is a bad thing. I think theologically you could even defend that pain is a bad thing. But you could also at the same time theologically say pain is a necessary part of the human experience, and we will always have that. And so alleviating pain, I'm not sure, is a reasonable point of argument from a theological side. Women, clergy women, feminist theologians, feminist Christian theologians, have brought into the arena of theology some new thinking, and I think it's worth hearing. Don't turn it off because it has the word feminist written with it. It's become such a catchphrase. But all feminists are trying to do in the Christian community are to expand the concrete range of choices of women, for women to take on a full range of personhood and be full, credible moral agents. The thinking of feminist theologians is that that has not been the case, that women have not been allowed to be full moral agents, that women in the past, that this procreative task that women have was really left in the hands of women for a number of years. It was passed on from mother to daughter, midwives. It was a women's community, and only in recent years when the medical community has been taken over by men did it become a medical issue rather than a procreative issue. I think that's an argument worth listening to. It isn't one that you have to swallow hook, line, and sinker, but it's one that I think deserves a hearing when we're making our choices about abortion. Protestants are generally, and I think this is true, are generally pro-choice because we feel that the priesthood of the believer is a very important bottom line theological task of the individual faithful person. That this is, that abortion is an issue that good, clear-thinking Christian people cannot agree on. And we can't agree on it because there's nothing clear in the Bible about it. We do not all agree when a fetus takes on full human life. We don't. And because of that, our tendency is to say, let's talk about all of the moral issues involved. Let's talk about the economic issues involved. Let's talk about the health issues involved. Let's talk about the quality of life issues. I think that this is not a matter of good and evil. Ethicists and many theologians tend to paint pictures of right and wrong, good and bad, sin and righteousness, with the assumption that we can gain perfection in our human finitude. And I don't agree that that's the case, and I think theologically the Bible will back me up there. We can attempt to be the best we can be, and we can picture God's kingdom out there in its perfection, and we can strive toward it, but we're not going to get there by ourselves. Therefore, theologically, we are left with being human or being human. and it's being wrong or being wrong. And it's being sinful or being sinful, being evil or being evil. And many of these issues end up so that our choices are evil versus evil. I don't believe in throwing away life, any life. But I also don't believe in narrowing and restricting a person's own choice, their humanity, by telling them what they are to do with their bodies. I do believe it is a body issue. And many theologians will claim this is their argument, that we are not a soul and a body separated. I mean, that's a Gnostic argument that was early done away with by the church, and it was called a heresy. We are a body soul. We are a body being. Part of our creative purpose is our whole body. Our personhood is part of who we are. And so a fetus is dependent upon the mother, is still a part of that mother until when? Until viable, until machines will keep it breathing even though the brain says not. I don't know. But that's why it has to be a family decision. That's why it has to be a woman's decision. That's why I think we shouldn't legislate this kind of morality, because we don't know and we don't agree. Sometimes when the choices are not good on both sides, and they're not always good. I mean, babies that are what if they're not going to die at birth? What if they're only going to live a month or two? I mean, do we condemn a baby to 2 months of pain, hoping that maybe there's going to be miraculous recovery? What if the family loses its house and its other 7 children are now homeless as the result of the medical bills? What if society itself can't afford how far we've gone with our medical knowledge? I mean, there were babies kept alive up there that will live, but there was not a baby that left undamaged. I mean, my girl was the healthiest girl there. She has a 60% chance. A healthy premature baby has a 60% chance of major learning disabilities. They spend the first weeks or months of their lives in an incubator. Touched how often? When they're fed, you know, maybe. How often? What if you've got 7 children and your baby's down here from Idaho? You don't even see your baby for months. Now, I'm not saying these babies should have been aborted. That's not my issue. I'm saying this is a real complex issue. And I don't think we can't predict what these individual situations are. It is a family issue. It is a woman's issue.
Have a lot of women clapping quite aggressively on this issue. We now have plenty of time for an interesting discussion, I hope. We should start with, and are there questions from the audience? Several questions here. Maybe what we ought to start with is maybe addressing what Reverend Darnell indicated, some of these social issues. What does the pro-life position or the moderate position require of us as a society if we are going to demand that women continue pregnancy? Well, is that a good question to start with?
Do you want us to come up here?
Sure,
so
yeah.
If you want to see what I think about this, and I think Richard agrees with me, read the guest editorial in the July issue of Utah Holiday Magazine. You'll get the full story. Briefly, I perfectly well agree these are complicated sorts of situations, and I agree that we need to do much more as a society in a lot of areas in terms of support for unwed mothers, for problem pregnancies. There's all sorts of things we need to do. It has to be part of a broader package dealing with these kinds of issues. But that doesn't mean, because there are all these other social things that have to go as part of the package, that this too shouldn't be one part of the package. That some moderate position defending the right of the fetus shouldn't be part of the package. The problem about situations being complex is that life is complex. Most of the murders committed in the United States are committed by people who knew each other. And of that, most of them are among people who were good friends, former good friends, all sorts of things. If you want to hear complex human drama, there's complex human drama. Now that is complex. We need to do more to deal with those kinds of situations before they get out of hand. But would anyone in this room care to tell me that that doesn't mean the mere argument about complexity means that we shouldn't, that one part of the dealing with those kinds of complex divorce kinds of situations that lead to those kinds of cases, one part of the way of dealing with that isn't this?
I think that the Reverend's remarks are apt and in many respects dead on, and I think the reason they are apt is the reason why we cannot take an extreme pro-life view and have that view ultimately prevail either in the courts or in the workaday world. You have to have a realm where you, as I stated in my comments, where you balance a woman's autonomy rights against fetal rights. I also firmly believe, however, the current regime goes far too far in the maternal rights direction. The fact of the matter is there is another life involved. The fact that that raises complexities and difficult issues simply does not avoid the fundamental moral reality that there's another life involved. And whether or not that the court chooses to ignore it in Roe versus Wade. It said, well, we can't tell when life begins, so we're not going to address it. Well, by not addressing it, they simply said, you can kill life up to 24 weeks. That's not an answer. I mean, that doesn't avoid the question. That simply says, we can't address it, so kill them. We can't avoid addressing that question. We have to address it, and all I'm saying is, let's make a reasoned choice. Let's put all the cards on the table and say, here are the complexities and here are the moral ambiguities and here are the difficulties and here are the reasons why we also should protect the unborn. And then let the people and their legislators draw a line. Social responsibility. I don't think that you can legislate in abortion policy in isolation. One of the real problems with many of the legislative enactments that have been proposed, one of the real problems with the legislation that was proposed in Idaho and that is going to be reintroduced here in Utah, is that it attempts to balance this entire controversy on the back of the woman. And that is simply not only unfair, it's unwise and unworkable. Women are faced with terribly difficult choices when they become pregnant, especially those choices become more difficult the more the pregnancy deviates from a standard ideal of support and health and all of that. The minute you start deviating from those standard ideals, you have terrible problems. Now, what the Supreme Court did in Roe is said, well, okay, we've got all these problems, so we'll let the woman take care of them by deciding to abort. I don't see that as a very good solution, just in the same way that I don't think just simply saying no abortion is a very good solution either. What you do is you put in place legal structures and programs that assist and support women in problem pregnancies. We need to, among other things, beef up our parental responsibility acts. Fathers who father children should be held strictly responsible for the costs and care of that child from the moment of conception. I think, I'm an attorney and I deal a lot with child support cases on a pro bono basis, and I'm just appalled at the status of the law, that we let fathers get away with what they get. That's one thing that needs to be done. We need to provide the kinds of social supports and maybe taxation supports that will permit a woman to keep her child. If we have social programs available that make it possible and economically feasible for a woman to keep her child, that should discourage abortion also. Another thing that we have to recognize is a lot of this can't be done legally. It has to be done by changing people's attitudes and approaches. One of the reasons women abort now is because of the rampant sexism in American society. We simply don't permit women to take off the time and have the support to have a baby. If you must work, and you are in a position where you cannot take off time to have a baby, and if you do, you're going to be out of work, and the welfare system is insufficient for numerous reasons to support your family or the children you're going to have, what are you going to choose to do? You're going to choose to abort. If we're going to avoid those decisions, we need to change some of the structures in society that now people take for granted almost unthinkingly.
After 40 years of medical practice as a family doctor, there's much I could say on this, because I remember the good old coat hanger days when abortion was illegal. But I won't go into that. In this pro-choice, no-choice argument that we have here, which is what it really is, there's one simple question I'd like to ask the men on the panel who are debating this as if it were civil rights or something else. How many times have you been pregnant?
I've heard that claim before. It's rubbish. It's worse than that. It's complete nonsense. No, it's an absurd response to the question. And I'll tell you why. How many of you in this room protest the South African situation? Everybody, right? Doesn't like it? Why? You're not South Africans. None of you are.
We didn't ask
you to like it. No! I mean, the point is, this is the most specious sort of claim imaginable. My students... my students in first year philosophy courses learned that this is a logical fallacy. It really is. Tell me what's wrong with my position.
Restate the question in this way and see if we can maybe
get
something out of this.
Set of claims.
Okay, let me restate it. Let me restate the question in this way. This is from my question. It has been noted that statistically a woman is much more likely to die as a result of pregnancy than from abortion. Given these risks, shouldn't the woman have the right to decide whether or not to continue a pregnancy?
Those statistics vary throughout pregnancy.
Those statistics were presented in a panel on medical ethics by a fellow who's a doctor and a bishop.
Yeah, those statistics are valid, but they change throughout pregnancy. That is, at some points in pregnancy, it's more dangerous to have an abortion, or at least as dangerous, the further along the term fetus is. The risk, it seems to me, if you look at the actual data on not the comparison of risks, but the actual risks involved, they're really quite low. I don't think those are unreasonable risks that we should ask people to bear if what we're talking about is the taking of a human life. Now, let me get back to that question, because it's a really fundamental question. A question that only women can talk about this.
No, it's not that.
Then make the decision about it. Can only a... Okay, okay.
Given the fact that they're the ones taking the risk.
Okay, let me... If that's true, then that legitimates all sorts of other things. Then that legitimates letting the South Africans alone, without pressure from the outside, make a decision about the South African situation. That is exactly what it does. It absolutely does. It's their country, not ours. It legitimates the white and black Southerners. What it does is legitimate, when we had the civil rights movement, letting the Southerners, it's their territory, it's their society, it isn't ours, Why do you shake your head? That's exactly the argument you're making.
No.
Don't say I'm comparing oranges and apples. Demonstrate to me that I'm not comparing oranges, that I'm comparing oranges and apples. Don't say it. Demonstrate it. And don't come back and say, well, it isn't the same case. Why isn't it the same case? Tell you what the fallacy is here.
Okay.
They're raising all hands. The fallacy is that it's a very old logical fallacy. You can get any logic textbook over here in the university library and look it up. It's in the first chapter or two. It's called an ad hominem argument. What it is... What? There's not any more to argument than logic.
Let's go on. Prime factor right now.
We'll get on to something else.
Let's go on to the
yeah.
I'll talk to you about that later.
Yeah.
Okay, right here. And then you, and then Jean.
How many?
I just have a couple of really quick points that have occurred to me that I'd like to make. One is, I'm always intrigued to get involved on this particular debate, but I'm very disappointed at the makeup of the panel. I'm always happy to hear the boys' opinions on the subject, and I'm not discounting your opinion at all. But we've heard a lot of male opinion and male argument and male attitudes with respect to this opinion, with respect to this subject. And to be quite honest, from my perspective, which may be more radical than some, I only heard one moderate argument today on the panel, and this was by the last person who spoke. I agree with you very much that this is a matter of public debate, to go to a point that you made, but this illustrates for me quite clearly that it is not yet a matter of public debate, because Humberto Maturana's book, The Tree of Knowledge, says violence is holding an opinion so strongly that another person's opinion is false and they must change. And I'm not sure if you were aware that this was happening sometimes during your arguments, but your imperatives are so strong and pernicious in a fashion that they silence people who might, in fact, have another opinion. The abortion debate does not center only on whether or not you are a relativist or whether or not the fetus is alive. There are some very good arguments. For those of you who wish to read more on the subject, in the book Beyond Domination by Carol Gould, there is a fabulous article on the abortion question, which is prepared to say that the fetus is a life, but that it truly is a question of balancing the rights of something that is a potential with the value that is inherent in a woman. And very often in these debates, I hear people saying the fetus has a right, and I feel deeply in my heart from the experiences that I've had with my dear and close friends who have, in fact, been through this process, that we do not value women. You said that it's a matter of death, but women are being killed in fashions more than through abortion. Women are not valued for themselves. They're not valued for their moral opinions. I would cherish and treasure the ability to hear the women in this audience speak about what they feel is the morality of abortion, because Carol Gilligan says women reason in a different moral fashion than men, whether or not you agree with her. And I would suspect that were we to listen to the women's voices and were the women to feel free to stand up in such an environment and say, here is what I feel in my heart, that you may in fact hear different things. And I wouldn't call them relativists. I wouldn't write them off and say relativism leads us inexorably towards death, because this isn't the case. So you may respond if you wish, but I would much prefer to just hear comments from women in the audience, and no offense to the men, but I would really cherish that were the women prepared to speak.
Do you want to have a couple of comments?
I'd like to have a couple of more
questions.
This woman in the blue. Mm-hmm. Can I ask questions? Please.
Yeah, they need it for the tapes.
Okay. Well, I just wondered, there's been no discussion, maybe it isn't relevant, but there's a choice made before you get pregnant, and that's the choice to have intercourse. You know, and I don't understand how much of the abortion that we have that's going on in our country today results from women who are married and who have pregnancies that are unwanted for various reasons, and from women who we could maybe go back to a different moral standard or start teaching or educating a different moral standard and not get pregnant in the first place and not be faced with abortion. I mean, I think there's a lot of merit to that consideration. There are lots of reasons for young people not to have intercourse besides not getting pregnant. There are lots of psychological and spiritual reasons, you know, that for your own health and happiness. But I wonder how much of the abortion results from unwed people or people who are, whom we could educate that for their own good, for many reasons, they would be better off not engaging in sexual abortion.
Say two statistics. Just two statistics that might be of importance here. One is, according to the most recent study by the Alan Guttmacher Institute, which is the research arm of Planned Parenthood, 50% of the women in their study who came into a clinic seeking abortion were not using contraceptives during the six-month period prior to their coming in for an abortion. That was 50%. Now, that's down from studies in the early 1970s, which found that 90% of the women seeking abortion had not been using any kind of effective contraception. But it still is 50% according to Planned Parenthood. The other statistic I might point out to you is that women in every public opinion poll that's been done, women hold more conservative attitudes on questions about when human life begins and abortion in general than men do. And that's been true for 30 years in this society.
I want to let Nancy have respond to this, and then Jean will take a question.
Jean, do you want to get Jean first? Or?
Nancy's just fine. Everybody calls me Nancy. I do have just a couple of comments, and these aren't arguments or anything. There typically is an assumption, however, by many people that in a pro-choice situation, no one is there to argue for the fetus. My contention is that no one can argue for the fetus better than the parents, and of the two, likely better than the mother, for the reason that they are more intimately related, but also will be more intimately related, at least the way we're set up right now. Women take the major part of the responsibility for childbearing and rearing.
I've just been given the time sign, so I'd like to thank everybody. I'm sorry, Jean. If you have questions and what you'd like to address, you're welcome to come up. I appreciate your attendance. Thank you.
Born to a parent there.